You know, when we look at the highest levels of global power, whether it's the Pentagon, the State Department, or like the West Wing, there is this expectation that it all just functions like a giant, highly engineered machine.
Right, yeah, like a totally frictionless process.
Exactly. You feed a policy objective into one end, the gears turn in perfect synchronization, and this predictable, rational, diplomatic result just pops out the other side.
I mean, it is incredibly comforting to think the world works that way. You read the org chart and you just assume the flow chart is reality.
But then you look at the actual reality of the West Wing or the literal chaos of a battlefield, and you realize the machine doesn't exist. We are dealing with a decision-making landscape that is deeply, messily human. The gears grind, you know, the operators disagree.
Yeah, the military actually has a term for this. They call it friction. The blueprint says one thing, but the human beings executing it introduce variables, ego, and miscommunication.
Which brings us to today. Welcome to today's deep dive, where we are exploring a person who might understand that friction better than anyone else alive.
Oh, absolutely.
We have a massive stack of source material sitting in front of us today. We are looking at a comprehensive intelligence-style analysis report from August 2026, complete with timelines, declassified policy documents, and institutional profiles. And our mission today is to distill all of this down so you can be the smartest person in the room on this topic.
It's a dense dossier for sure.
Yeah, it is. We are unpacking the multi-layered career of H.R. McMaster. He's not just a retired three-star U.S. Army general. He's a decorated combat hero, a best-selling historian, and a former national security advisor who had this highly publicized clash of operational styles with the president he served.
And honestly, he's a fascinating figure because of how those roles bleed into each other.
Right. And whether you are trying to make sense of the breaking news you're seeing today in 2026 about U.S. troop movements in Asia, or you just want to know how the highest levels of global power actually operate behind closed doors, understanding his worldview is basically the ultimate cheat code.
It really is the lens for a lot of modern policy.
Okay, let's unpack this. Give us the 30-second high-level synthesis of who this guy actually is, because the sources paint the picture of three very distinct identities.
Well, if you read through this entire stack of analysis, he operates in three mutually reinforcing layers. First, you have the soldier. This is the combat-tested armor officer who learned his trade in the deserts of the Middle East.
Okay, the on-the-ground guy.
Exactly. Second, you have the historian, the scholar who went deep into the archives to figure out the exact mechanisms of why smart people make catastrophic strategic failures.
Which is a rare pivot for a combat officer.
Very rare. And third, you have the policymaker, the national security advisor who tried to build an architecture of decision-making in a White House that fundamentally resisted traditional architecture. To understand the policy decisions he made in the West Wing, you really have to understand the combat boots he wore first.
So let's start right there on the battlefield. February 1991, the Gulf War. He is a captain commanding Eagle Troop at the Battle of 73 Easting. The sources highlight this as a defining moment, but I want to understand how it actually played out on the ground.
Oh, it's intense. This is a legendary, lightning-fast, armored battle against the Iraqi Republican Guard. He's commanding a troop of Abrams tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles, and they are advancing through this massive sandstorm.
Like zero visibility.
Practically zero. The weather is terrible. Suddenly, he crests a slight ridge and finds himself looking directly down into an Iraqi defensive position.
Whoa, so he is completely face to face with the enemy at that point.
Literally face to face.
Yeah.
Now, standard military doctrine in that specific scenario often dictates that you halt, establish a defensive line, and wait for the rest of your larger unit to catch up so you have overwhelming force.
Play it safe, basically.
Right. But he realizes the Iraqis are caught totally off guard, his seconds to act. So he chooses to exploit the fleeting advantage and orders an immediate aggressive attack right into the enemy formation.
It works.
It works perfectly. He destroys the Iraqi positions rapidly. He ultimately won a Silver Star for his actions right there.
But the U.S. had a massive technological advantage in that fight, right? Better thermal sights, better armor, GPS. The overriding narrative back home after the Gulf War was that technology had essentially solved warfare.
That was totally the narrative. I mean, the Pentagon and the public watched the smart bombs on CNN and concluded that technology wins wars. But he walked away from 73 Easting with the exact opposite conclusion.
Right, really? Why?
He believed his troop won, not because of the thermal sights, but because of decentralized human initiative. He realized the machine still needs a highly trained, aggressive human driving it, making judgment calls in the chaos.
So the tech is just a tool, not the actual solution.
Exactly. And we see that human element tested in a completely different way 14 years later. Fast forward to 2005. He is in Iraq again, commanding the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in a city called Tal Afar.
Okay, so a very different setting from the open desert.
Oh, entirely different. This is not a lightning-fast tank battle. It is a slow, messy, urban counterinsurgency. The U.S. military strategy in Iraq at that time heavily relied on massive forward operating bases.
Like troops living behind huge walls.
Yeah, these huge, heavily fortified bases. They would drive out in armored convoys, raid a neighborhood, kick down doors, chase body counts, and then retreat back to the safe base.
But the sources show he completely flipped that script.
He did. He looked at the standard orthodoxy and realized it was alienating the population. So he ordered his troops to abandon the massive safe bases. He broke his regiment down into smaller units and had them build permanent, vulnerable outposts directly inside the hostile neighborhoods of Tal Afar.
Which has to be incredibly risky for his soldiers.
Highly risky. I mean, they're right in the line of fire constantly.
Yeah.
But it was the only way to build actual trust.
Wow. Just by being present and visible.
Exactly. By living in the neighborhoods, his soldiers learned the local grievances. They started untangling the complex sectarian politics between Sunni and Shia groups. They focused on population security and restoring local governance, rather than just tallying up how many insurgents they killed.
It's basically a complete paradigm shift.
It was. And it actually became the blueprint for the wider troop surge in Iraq later on.
Okay, wait. I'm looking at the timeline in this dossier, and I am genuinely confused. He has a silver star from the Gulf War. He just successfully pacified an entire Iraqi city by rewriting the tactical playbook. And right after this, he gets passed over for promotion to brigadier general.
Twice.
That makes zero sense. How does the military not immediately promote someone with that track record?
What's fascinating here is that it highlights a massive tension within the institutional bureaucracy of the army. While there's no official record stating the explicit reasons he was passed over in 2006 and 2007, the third-party assessments in our sources view him as an iconoclast.
So he was too blunt for the Pentagon to handle?
Pretty much. He was a reform-minded officer who constantly told the institution it was fighting the war wrong. And the army is a massive hierarchy. It desperately needs people who challenge assumptions to win wars. But its promotion system also heavily rewards officers who build coalitions, protect institutional narratives, and play the bureaucratic staff game smoothly.
Which doesn't sound like his style at all.
Not at all. He had a reputation for being intellectually overconfident, sometimes didactic, and entirely willing to make senior generals uncomfortable.
It's fascinating that the exact trait that made him effective in combat, refusing to blindly follow broken orthodoxy, is what temporarily stalled his career.
Right, the friction we talked about.
Yeah, and instead of just keeping his head down and playing the game, he decides to investigate historically why that institutional orthodoxy fails, which takes him straight from the battlefield into the academic archives.
Quite the pivot.
Yeah. He gets a PhD in history from the University of North Carolina, which turns into his 1997 book, Dereliction of Duty.
And this book is, honestly, the Rosetta Stone for his entire worldview. He looked at the Vietnam War, and he asked a specific causal question. How did this disaster actually happen?
Because the standard military narrative at the time was somewhat defensive, right?
Very defensive. The military line was basically, the civilian politicians micromanaged us, they picked the bombing targets, they didn't let us win.
But he digs into the primary documents and says no. The blame lies heavily on the military itself, specifically the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Exactly. He outlines the exact bureaucratic games the Joint Chiefs played. During the Vietnam escalation, President Lyndon Johnson and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara were pursuing a strategy of incremental escalation.
Just a slow buildup of troops and pressure.
Right. And the military leaders privately knew that a slow, incremental buildup was mathematically impossible to win. It would just bleed the U.S. dry.
So they knew it was a doomed strategy from the start.
They absolutely knew. But instead of marching into the Oval Office and telling the president that hard truth, the chiefs compromised.
Wait, they compromised on military strategy when lives are on the line?
They compromised their professional integrity to protect their individual service budgets. It's wild. The Air Force wanted funding for new bombers. The Army wanted funding for ground troops. So they gave the civilians the agreeable answers they wanted to hear, hid the true troop requirements and stayed silent about the immense risks.
That is deeply cynical.
It is. And for him, the core professional duty of a military leader is to offer honest, unvarnished advice, even if it infuriates the president before carrying out lawful civilian orders. Silence to protect your career or your budget is a literal dereliction of duty.
So he carried this deep skepticism of comfortable lies into his later work at the Army Capabilities Integration Center, or RCS, where he was tasked with looking at the future of the Army. The source report highlights this concept he aggressively pushed back against, called the easy war fallacy.
Ah, yes. This was his warning against the pervasive American fantasy that new technology, drones, cyber capabilities, precision weapons, will make future war cheap, fast, and sterile.
Which people still believe today.
Constantly. But he points out that adversaries adapt. If they know we have precision airstrikes, they don't line their tanks up in the desert anymore like they did at 73 Easting. They fight in the gray zone.
We should define that for a second. The gray zone essentially means using tactics that fall just short of triggering an actual declared war. So like a massive cyber attack on a power grid, or funding a proxy militia in another country, or running a giant disinformation campaign.
Yes. Tactics that completely avoid our conventional military strengths.
Mm-hmm.
He argues that war remains a fundamentally human contest of wills.
It feels like that easy war fallacy is deeply ingrained in American culture. You watch a Hollywood movie and the crisis is always solved by a drone strike pushed from a sterile command room or some elite hacker typing furiously.
Right. The movie always ends with a neat technological fix.
Exactly. But he is basically looking at the Pentagon's obsession with shiny new tech and saying, a smart bomb doesn't matter if you have a dumb political strategy. Am I getting that right?
You're getting it perfectly. He calls for integrated statecraft. You have to subordinate the technology to a clear political concept. Technology is a tool, not magic.
Okay, so we have this guy who has forged this incredibly strong belief in unvarnished candor, deep historical context, and highly structured strategy. And that brings us to February 2017. He takes this exact philosophy straight into the West Wing.
It is the ultimate practical test of his theories.
Right. He steps in as Donald Trump's national security advisor, replacing Michael Flynn. And he walks into a National Security Council that the sources describe as needing immediate stabilization.
It was a very chaotic period in the White House.
So he tries to implement what is known as the honest broker model. I want to understand what that actually looks like when the doors are closed. Let's say there is a crisis in a foreign country. What does an honest broker do?
Well, in a typical administration, the interagency process is full of friction. The State Department drafts a memo advocating for a series of diplomatic concessions to ease the crisis. Meanwhile, the Pentagon drafts a memo advocating for deploying a carrier strike group as a show of force.
Two completely different approaches to the exact same problem.
Radically different.
Right.
Now, if you are a bad national security advisor, you take the memo you personally agree with, slide it across the Resolute desk to the president, and bury the other one.
So you just shape the policy based on your own bias.
Exactly. But if you are operating as an honest broker, which is what he tried to enforce, you force the State Department and the Pentagon into a room. You make them synthesize their arguments into a single, structured matrix of options, detailing the risks, costs, and historical context of both paths.
Okay, laying out all the cards on the table.
Yes. Then you present that rigorous, balanced document to the president so the president can make the best possible informed decision.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Looking at the source report, there is a fundamental structural mismatch here between the advisor and the advisee.
A massive mismatch.
You have an advisor who loves structured process, dense reading, formal option matrices, and rigorous historical debate. And he is paired with a president who prefers intuition, short conversational briefings, and improvisational leader-to-leader bargaining.
It is a profound contrast in operating styles. And, you know, we need to explicitly remind the listener here, the source material is not taking sides or passing judgment on which leadership style is objectively better or worse.
Right. Total impartiality.
We're strictly reporting the analysis of how these two vastly different approaches interacted in the same room.
We're just looking at the mechanics of the relationship. And the report notes that combining these two styles inevitably led to what it calls cumulative incompatibility.
Which is a very polite way of saying it just wasn't going to work long term.
Yeah. And this wasn't just a workplace drama about how long a briefing memo should be. It directly impacted global geopolitics, specifically how the United States treats its allies.
This was the core substantive clash between the two of them. Because both the president and his advisor actually agreed on a fundamental point. U.S. allies needed to spend more on their own defense. They both felt allies had been free-riding on American security guarantees for way too long.
Right. But they disagreed entirely on why that mattered and what the baseline value of an alliance actually is.
Exactly. The president viewed alliances largely through the lens of near-term reciprocity. It was transactional. He was looking at trade balances, direct financial payments, and visible, immediate concessions. If an ally wasn't paying their share, the underlying value of the alliance was openly questioned.
Whereas the advisor, drawing on his history and his Clausewitzian worldview, viewed alliances as accumulated strategic capital.
Yes. Strategic capital is the key phrase. He believed that maintaining a massive forward military presence and a dense network of allies acts as a daily deterrent. It prevents wars from starting in the first place, which, in his view, is vastly cheaper than having to fight one.
So it sounds like the president viewed an alliance like a gym membership. If you don't pay your monthly fee, you get locked out of the building immediately. But his advisor viewed an alliance like a neighborhood watch. Everyone's safety depends on mutual trust and showing up, regardless of who actually bought the walkie-talkies.
That is a perfect analogy. And if the neighborhood watch starts publicly arguing over who pays for the walkie-talkies, the adversaries notice. The deterrent value drops.
The bad guys see the vulnerability.
Exactly. This plays out clearly in the THAAD episode from April 2017. THAAD is a highly advanced U.S. missile defense system deployed in South Korea to protect against North Korean threats. The arrangement was that South Korea provided the land and the U.S. paid for the billion-dollar system.
But President Trump publicly states out of nowhere that South Korea should pay the $1 billion for it.
Right. It caused immediate panic in Seoul. They were totally blindsided. Behind the scenes, the source report notes that the National Security Advisor quietly got on the phone with his South Korean counterpart. He had to manage the friction.
That had to be an incredibly awkward phone call.
I can only imagine. But he reassured Seoul that the U.S. would honor the existing agreement and foot the bill while carefully acknowledging to the president that future burden-sharing arrangements could be renegotiated.
So he's constantly walking this tightrope. But despite this constant tension, he did help draft the 2017 National Security Strategy. It's an incredibly fascinating compromise document.
It really is. It actually manages to blend the president's economic nationalism with the advisor's traditional alliance-centered deterrence, famously labeling China and Russia as revisionist powers competing against the U.S.
But the structural compromise couldn't hold forever. By April 2018, he departs the administration. He is replaced by John Bolton, who the report describes as a much more unilateralist hawk, someone who shared the president's deep skepticism toward multilateral constraints and international agreements.
This raises an important question, though, about what happens to that strategic architecture when he leaves, because it proves the friction wasn't just about him being an active duty general in a civilian space. It was a clash over the fundamental philosophy of American power.
Which brings us to the present day. Even though he left the government, his framework for understanding the world hasn't changed at all. According to this August 2026 intelligence report, his worldview is highly relevant to the geopolitics unfolding right now.
Yeah, as of August 2026, he remains highly active in shaping the national security debate. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He lectures at Stanford. He chairs an advisory board at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And he sits on the board of Zoom. He's also constantly talking to global leaders on his program, Today's Battlegrounds.
And the source report highlights a massive debate happening right now in 2026 regarding South Korea. President Trump has ordered a major reduction in joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises. And our subject is out there publicly warning against this move.
Because he is warning that scaling back these joint military exercises might embolden Kim Jong-un.
But why does a military exercise matter so much if you're already doing diplomacy?
Because he argues you can't just rely on leader-to-leader diplomacy with North Korea. Diplomacy only works if it is backed by the credible, visible threat of a unified, combat-ready U.S.-South Korean alliance. If you remove the physical readiness, you remove your leverage.
The report categorizes his broader worldview as Clausewitzian competitive internationalism.
That's a mouthful.
It really is. But essentially, it means U.S. security is best preserved by having a strong domestic economic base embedded in a tight network of highly capable global allies and competing aggressively below the threshold of war so you never actually have to cross into a hot war.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, when you are scrolling through your news feed today and you see headlines about semiconductor supply chains in Taiwan or debates over NATO budgets or military exercises in the Indo-Pacific, His framework is one of the dominant lenses through which the U.S. national security establishment views those exact issues.
He left a lasting imprint, for sure.
He really helped normalize the idea that we are in a state of constant strategic competition across military, economic, and technological domains.
We have tracked a wild journey today, from cresting a desert ridge in a sandstorm at 73 Easting to building vulnerable outposts in the hostile neighborhoods of Tal Afar. From scouring the archives to uncover the bureaucratic failures of Vietnam, straight into managing the chaotic, improvisational friction of the West Wing.
It's an incredible arc.
It is. He emerges from these sources as the ultimate warrior scholar, a figure who refuses to believe that advanced technology or simple transactional deals will ever remove the messy, unpredictable human reality of geopolitics.
So what does this all mean for you?
Well, his entire philosophy rests on the idea that strong forward posture, robust alliances, and constant credible deterrence are the only things that prevent major wars. But the source material also outlines a compelling critic's case against him, and this is what we should leave you with.
Okay, let's hear it.
His critics argue this mindset creates endless cumulative commitments. If avoiding war requires you to constantly build up arms, fortify allies in every conceivable corner of the globe, and prepare endlessly for every possible contingency, at what point does the act of preparing for war everywhere trap you in the very conflicts you are trying to deter?
That's a really heavy question.
It is. Does competitive internationalism actually prevent the fire, or are we just stacking more dry wood around the house?
Are we just stacking more dry wood around the house? That is a brilliant image to end on. Because just like that expectation of a perfectly engineered machine we talked about at the beginning, when you look closely at the human machinery of global power, nothing is perfectly predictable. The friction is always there. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the headlines you see, look for the deeper history behind the news, and we'll catch you next time.